Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, we are joined by an exceptional leader with decades of experience driving transformational change and optimizing team performance. Maria Scarangella, the president of Scarangella Consulting, has honed her expertise across various leadership roles, from HR to overseeing large sales and operations units. She empowers organizations by building robust infrastructures and enhancing leader capabilities through data-driven strategies and executive coaching. In today's episode, Maria will share her profound insights on several critical topics: the current crisis of trust in the workforce, the importance of transparent leadership in new teams, key behaviors every leader should embody, and practical advice on setting impactful organizational goals and consequences. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Gruneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group, and today I'm joined by Maria Scarangella. Maria is the president of Scarangella Consulting. She also has some other really cool titles like talent strategist, executive coach, and HR economist. So we're going to dive into Maria's story today and really focus on the role of leadership in teamwork and leadership brand. So welcome to the show, Maria.
Thank you, Dane. I'm so happy to be here.
It's going to be fun. Tell me a little bit more, or tell our listeners a little bit more about you. How did you come to be doing this great work that you do?
So I started this 2 years ago. I had worked for Geico Insurance for 37 years, and I held leadership roles for 35 of the 37 years. I was a leader in HR, in sales and customer service, insurance operations, and my final role was leading talent for the organization. But after I retired, I wasn't sure what was next, and I actually failed at retirement because I started getting phone calls from people asking for advice, and from there it just built. And I became certified as a coach, and what I do now is work with leaders to become the best version of themselves. And I work with a lot of C-suite teams on how they want to lead, aligning their strategy to their ultimate goals and creating their rules of engagement.
Neat. That's really cool. And I'm going to have so many questions on the Geico experience. I mean, there's generally a theme that I'm exploring right now, which is that good teamwork, good leadership, good HR practices come from all functions. So the fact that you've lived all of these different functions on your journey is fascinating.
Thank you.
So let's dive straight in to that whole concept of creating a leadership brand and rules of engagement, because there's some interesting models out there, and people kind of sit on both sides of the fence. Some people say, well, how dare the leader tell us that this is how they work and that we have to conform to their way of working. And others are saying, well, absolutely, the leader should tell us how they work and how best we can access them. So there's mixed schools of thought. What's your sort of version and approach to that?
So my school of thought is, as a leader, the more transparent you are, the less time your team has to be focused on trying to figure out what you want from them. So because I was in so many different roles and in such completely different areas of the company, whenever I took over a new team, the very first meeting I would have with them was to discuss my leadership philosophy and what they could expect from me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't telling them what they had to do, but I wanted them to have a good understanding of how I led. And one of the most important things is that my job only exists to make the team better and for us to deliver business results. And success doesn't happen by accident. So it's a result of your actions and what you do and how you behave and how you work together. And if I'm a good leader, I know the strengths on my team and I know my own strengths and weaknesses. So I find people that can surround me, that can make up for the areas that I'm not strong. And I can rely on them for that. And they can rely on me for the areas where I am strong. So,
yeah,
you know, it's really creating that right patchwork and that right group of skills to deliver whatever your mission is.
Yes. And I like that approach of the very first meeting is about your leadership brand and rules of engagement. The reason I like it is that a lot of leaders, and I've been this person in the past too, will go on their listening tour and say, tell me more about you, tell me about the function, tell me about our customers. But that individual, to your point, they're sitting here going, gee, I wonder what Maria really wants to know.
Right.
I wonder what's important to her. And so they're guessing at how to respond, where if you're going out with your framework first, you're creating, I would imagine, some common language and framework for them to be responding back to.
Yeah. And Zane, you know, it goes back to trust. If I want you to be honest with me, then I need to make an effort to create trust. And I think right now, you know, post-COVID, we're in a crisis of trust. If you think about what's happened, you know, there's been so much turmoil over the past few years with COVID, it was the fear of, am I going to survive? Is my family going to survive? What
yes.
can happen economically? Who's telling the truth? And I think a lot of our institutions now are not as trusted as they were pre-COVID.
Interesting.
So I think businesses, if you really want to create that comfort level where people can thrive, you need to build trust and you need to give them hope that there's going to be more good things that come in the future if we work together. So that's another piece of my leadership philosophy, is giving people a vision for where we can go together and have them contribute to that vision and being really clear on what's our mission for the organization. How do we affect each other? How do we affect customers? How do we affect your business? What's our contribution? And then really providing an environment where they see they're an important role, and every role in the organization is important. Otherwise, you wouldn't be paid a salary.
Yeah. I like that. And I've heard a similar context described before of like, how do we leave our customers and our teammates better off for having shown up in work? And, you know, that's a very personal and team-centered framework, because as opposed to some of the larger, you know, big box kind of purpose, mission, values of large corporations, because you can really get into the work that you're doing in that department.
Yeah. And I really believe, to support that you create an environment of building rather than deconstruction. So it's about everybody on the team having a positive influence on each other. A positive influence always wins over negative. And that part of the foundation of trust, so that people are able to give feedback in a way that they can hear it. So it's not criticism. It's how we interact so we continue to help each other.
That's interesting. On support versus deconstruction, can you tell me a little bit more of what your definition of deconstruction is when it's going the wrong way?
So I think it's going the wrong way when you focus on what wasn't done without a strategy and a solution to solve the problem or the issue. And the first piece of that is really understanding the problem you're trying to solve.
Yeah.
And then having the forums for people to talk about what caused the issue, where did we fall short? And it's okay to make mistakes. It's not
yes.
okay to continue to repeat the same mistake, but you have to be able to explore why things aren't happening the way that you want them to, in a way that moves people forward. So never leave a strategy session with what went wrong. you leave with what went wrong, why did it go wrong, and what are we going to do differently to move forward? There's too many times that the discussion happened and it's just about what went wrong without the other pieces, because then you leave people in a state where they can't act. They're in a yes. state, they're in an emotional state that stops them from acting. And it also gives them somebody else to blame sometimes, rather than seeing their part in solving the problem.
I like that piece, their part in solving the problem. I know we were talking before the show that my emerging belief, the more I talk to guests in the future of teamwork, is that the future teams, the most successful teams, are ones where everyone on the team leads from every position. And so, you know, their part in solving a problem, it's not just the boss's job or accounting's job or sales's job. It's like, if we're a team, if we're responsible for a deliverable, we all need to partake.
Yeah, and part of that is making sure that everybody's using the same equation. So everybody's adding or subtracting, because a lack of understanding of where others are coming from creates confusion that could lead to assumptions or negative assumptions, and you really need to clarify. And one of the sayings that I like to use is, where you stand on an issue depends on where you sit in the organization. And it's critical, because each role comes from their discipline. And the whole reason that you have the multiple disciplines is to get that balance of power and then come to compromise to deliver what's best for the organization. So, for example, you could have people in sales that are doing a great job of getting a lot of contracts in. But if finance is saying, well, we're not getting paid and people are getting paid late, we're going to put restrictions on sales, that's a healthy conflict, because you want that. It's about getting that balance. So that's why I like that saying, because it really helps you think about, am I considering the other person's perspective and why they're reacting the way that they are, and what's important to them and what their goals are, to ensure that we get the best outcome for our whole company.
I like that. And it takes time to do that correctly, which is probably a good segue back into how you build out your 7 behaviors when you're thinking about leadership, brand, and rules of engagement.
Yeah. So let me tell you what the 7 behaviors are.
Yeah, that would be great.
So the first is knowing yourself. And that means being authentic, but knowing what you do well, knowing the areas that you need to continue to develop, and then understanding your people and your business. So once you know your own strengths and weaknesses, then you find people that have different strengths and weaknesses to build a diverse team, and diverse in thought, diverse in experience, diverse in communication styles, so that you get different perspectives. And then the third behavior is insist on realism and be decisive. So you may find there's times that people talk about, well, we hope we're going to get to this, but you have to be grounded in where you are today and what the real problems are, and not hide problems. Problems need to come to the surface so that they can be fixed, and it's not a reflection on an individual, it's for the organization to solve. And then once you understand what the problem is, be decisive, make a decision, move forward. You may have to revisit at a certain point if you made the wrong decision, but make a decision and take action. And then the fourth behavior is about setting goals and priorities. Everybody has to know what's important, and it can't be too many things. You know, there's probably 3 things that are most important, and decide on those 3 things and stay with them and communicate them and be consistent, because if everything's important, nothing's important.
Yeah.
So if you can start teaching your team what's the biggest priorities, what's most important, they start to prioritize on where they're going to make the biggest contribution and focus their time and effort on that. And, you know, we all know you can get caught up in email and be in email for the first 3 hours of the day and not Absolutely. Get anything accomplished. So knowing what's the most important thing really helps to, you know, I have to do three things on the three most important things by lunch.
Yeah.
And make some progress.
It gives you good constraints too.
Yeah.
I like that one a lot.
The next is reward the doers. So that's part of, you know, building a positive environment. Instead of focusing on what's not going getting done, really put a lot of energy and effort around celebrating the people that are getting things done. And celebrating doesn't mean a party. It means acknowledging and recognizing and communicating so that others have a model to follow. And then if they want to ask questions about how someone achieved that, they have a resource. And then coaching. And coaching is about helping people expand their capacity and stretching them to think beyond where they are now. And one of the things that I really like to say is that the belief, like unbridled belief by a coach, can help you achieve things that you never thought were possible.
What would be an example of that?
So setting a challenge for people, I can tell you a quick story.
That'd be great.
So when I was a sales director at Geico, I took over a team that was in worst. They were ranked 10 out of 10 for what we called ACALs. And that was how they had the conversation with the customer. And the challenge that I set out for the team was, this year, we're going to go from worst to first.
And I love it.
In December, we are going to celebrate, and everyone who participated in this is going to be part of the celebration. But the leadership team will be the ones that really drive this. And I had a team of managers that had supervisors under them, and then a team of hundreds of people. And we all agreed that we were going to deliver this team from worst to first. And, you know, in the first couple of conversations, people said, well, you know, how do we get there from here? And I said, let's not focus on that yet. Let's focus on what we're going to achieve, and then we'll work back from that. And it meant that everyone was committed. And I had a boss that loves to tell the story of how I would go to, so my daughters played softball. I was up in the hills in Temecula, California, which is north of San Diego. And we were at a softball tournament. And I would monitor calls every time, you know, all hours of the day and night, so that since we were a 24-hour staff, people knew that there was always someone that was listening, supporting. Supervisors were doing it as well, but I wanted to model the behavior. So I would listen to calls, and there was one time where I had to climb up to the top of this hill to get reception, but it was a Sunday night and I hadn't done it yet, and I wanted that team to know that I supported them.
Awesome.
And what I would do is send out the positive notes to the whole staff, and any areas of improvement would go directly to the person and their supervisor. So it was a way to reinforce positive behaviors. It was a way to give them recognition, and it was a way to support our whole team's mission towards getting to first. And we did get there, and we celebrated by all of us going out to a game, and we had a bunch of different events, but it was a success.
I really like the way in that example you set the challenge, you visualize living the results of success. And then you built in some of those routine behaviors or rituals to reinforce along the way. That's really powerful.
Yeah, rituals are very important because you have to have something to rely on, especially when things are not going well.
Yeah. Which for a lot of teams happens a lot of the time.
And that brings me to another one of my my leadership philosophies, and that's having a plan and expecting consistent execution of the plan. So the plan's not always going to deliver 100% success, and some items are out of your control, but you can control your plans and your actions, and not accepting an excuse for not executing the plan was really important. So if you lose, but you did everything that you committed to doing, that's okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. So that's seven big ones. Just running back up to the top, I've got a few questions. So on knowing yourself, when you think about the competence that you have, when you're working with a leader, are you using tools and diagnostics like an MBTI or a Strengths Finder, or is it a 360 degree to understand what other people are saying about them and their strengths, or is it something else entirely?
So when I work with teens now, one of the things that I find very, very effective is I first do a discovery session to really get to know them and what their values are. And then I ask them to give me the names of four people who they want to strengthen their relationship with. So it could be someone that they doesn't really know them well, or someone that they have had interactions with that didn't go as planned, and their boss. And then I have a series of questions that I ask. And from that, I develop trends on what their strengths are, areas to develop.
Great.
And behaviors that we can change. And then from there, we create a development plan. And once we create the development plan, I set up a triad meeting with the person I'm coaching, their boss, and myself. And the person who's being coached shares the trends, they share their development plan, and they ask for feedback. And then we also include how they're going to hold themselves accountable. And I like the idea, I don't know how you feel about accountability buddies.
I love it. So who is the accountability buddy in your framework then?
So they choose.
They can pick someone.
They put, you know, they will include how they want their boss to support them, but they also identify someone else in the organization that can help reinforce, that they can check in with, who can say, yeah, in that meeting, you nailed it. I saw you changing your behaviors, but when you lost your temper in the next meeting, it was a completely different
You fell off.
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, I'm a huge fan of a lot of military organization, which is where a lot of HR thinking has evolved from over the years. And when you look at some of the higher performing special operations teams, what's fascinating is that they make it okay to fail. In fact, they have to fail all the time for the stuff that they're doing, so that when they're, you know, downrange, they're on target and perform. But what's interesting is you'll see people hold each other accountable. You'll allow that kind of flare up in the moment. You're not necessarily docking someone right there and then, and distracting everyone else from the work that they're doing, but you're circling back. So you often see people will buddy up, and hold themselves accountable in that way too.
Well, that's the other big benefit of having a rules of engagement for a leadership team, especially a C-suite team, because then that you open the door to get that consistent feedback where people are saying, okay, you know, in this situation, it didn't necessarily happen. And you also have some rules for how you're going to deal with conflict.
Yes.
Which there's always going to be conflict. If there isn't conflict, then there's other problems.
There's a bigger problem.
Right.
Yeah, I would agree. I also like the way you set up that triad, Maria, because there's a lot of coaching purists out there who are like, well, the work that I do with my coachee is the work that I do, and they can share what they choose to share. But I like that you're setting out an upfront accountability and expectation. And let's be honest, the pace of change right now in teams is so great. Fatigue and change put together, it makes it even more tricky that sometimes you don't have 6 or 12 months to go through a personal journey of discovery and change your style. Sometimes you need to start showing up, making a difference next week or next month.
Right. And it's all about success. I mean, if the more success you feel, the more engaged you'll be, the more you'll achieve for the organization. So it's a way of shortening that process and allowing them to feel successful much quicker. And in those conversations, it gives me the opportunity to see the relationship between the boss and the leader and get to understand what some of those dynamics are. So that educates my coaching as well.
No, that is powerful. You then had knowing your people and business. So for a new leader, particularly if they're a leader that's come from outside of the organization, let's say they've hired into a VP role of a sales function, but you know they've done lots of sales in their career, but they haven't sold this product or service. Any keys to approaching that discovery effort with that leader?
I think the first part is getting to know the people individually. And I do mean, you know, you don't have to spend a lot of time in a social setting, but you should know who the people are and what motivates them and what drives them and what they think they're good at and how they can help you learn the business. Because if you learn it through your people, you're learning about the both aspects at the same time. Yes, you can go off and you know, study the documents and the product design and all of that if you want. But if you can connect to the people and allow them to see that this is not your area of expertise right now, but you're going to learn from them. And it gives you the chance to build and give them some good coaching as they're sharing with you.
I like that a lot. And I really want to play back that statement you made. Learning through the people allows you to learn the business at the same time as the person. So it's a highly leveraged activity for all of us who are time poor.
Yeah. And, you know, the good thing is that there's constant change. So we should always be in a learning mindset. And sometimes when you step into that beginner mindset, you see things that someone who's too close to the product or too close to the business doesn't see.
I really like that. That is powerful. I heard recently on another podcast that when you bring other bright people in who are not carrying the domain expertise and you have a conversation, it's amazing how much the outsider can create perspective to solve the problem for you because they're not burdened with your assumptions.
Right.
And blind spots, they come in and look at it fresh. So that is powerful.
And they may also have a better customer perspective because
yes.
We don't always educate our customers.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. That's a really good point. You then move on to, I'm going to jump past realism into goals and priorities. So picking a top three, I was having a conversation with a future guest of the podcast today. And she was talking to me about this construct of intentional subtraction, which is that we're all so busy, we're overdoing work in most of our roles, leaders or not. It takes a real discipline to pare it down and say, well, these are my top three. Because normally when we're feeling stressed and anxious in a team, we just load more work on to feel better because we're doers, right? How have you seen some of those approaches that you work on with leaders actually land with impact for the leader and for their team on goals and priorities?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually have a patent pending model.
Nice.
That I use. And the very first step in that is understanding what is the organization's goals. And it's funny because when I'll sit down with a group of leaders and I ask what the goals are, what are the two most important goals? Limit it to two.
Yep.
And they'll say, that's crazy. We've got 100 KPIs. Yes. It can't be two. So I typically say, well, what's your CEO's bonus based on?
Oh, that's a good
That's
lens.
Probably the two most important goals. And it's, you know, growth and profit. Or I work with a lot of private equity backed firms. And for them, EBITDA is critical. That's usually the number one. And then a second is revenue growth. Or for some of the manufacturing, it's, you know, reducing the costs or reducing inventory, you know, something along those lines. But when you really sit down, there are two goals. And those are the two things that every level of the organization has to be aligned to how they contribute to.
Oh, I like that.
So after you have the two goals, there's usually six levers, you know, increasing sales and revenue, reducing costs, maximizing capital, developing talent. You know, there's, depending on the organization, you can get down to six levers. And then how does the level below that, how does every vice president, how does their team contribute to those?
Yeah.
And when you start to do it in that way, light bulbs go off and people say, okay, so yes, I have 30 KPIs that I'm watching, but yeah, there is two levers that I contribute the most to. So if I organize around, there are some actions that will vary and it's not just two actions, but if there's
sure.
really two things that I contribute to the organization and I focus my team on that and I monitor our progress to that, that takes away so much of the noise.
Yes.
And they feel like there's a weight that's lifted off because it's, okay, this is achievable. I can do this. I can contribute to these things.
I really like that. And the way that you I'm a very visual person. So the way you've described that there, Maria, I see this really neat cascade. And not only does it flow down from the top goals into the teams and how they contribute, I'm now seeing how teams interplay with other teams. Because once it's documented, you can communicate it, share it, understand where someone might be coming from.
Exactly. And that's the graphic that we use. So
right.
What are the two big goals? What are the levers? What are the individual contributors? You know, and then you go down to each individual and how does my daily actions contribute to the overall mission of the company? And wow, I actually do have an impact.
Yeah. That's very cool. I really like that flow on goals and priorities. And then doers. So reward the doers. Here's a quote I saw the other day on LinkedIn from a good friend of mine, Jeffrey Roach. He said, have we sort of misstepped in creating human doers in the workplace versus human beings? So that there is a potentially negative connotation that if you're always doing, you're not being a member of the team and you might get a little bit too siloed in your own work and efforts as a team member, but you've got a different view.
Yeah. See, my view is reward the people that are contributing to the team and helping to deliver results. So you may reward someone for successfully navigating a conflict.
Wonderful.
Or you might reward someone for bringing together other parts of the organization to share what they're doing because they can help. So it's not necessarily I completed this task.
Got it.
I didn't necessarily complete it by myself. It's about what are the things that the organization needs this team to accomplish and who is helping to advance that mission.
That's a great clarification. So I've written here doers of teamwork, not tasks.
Yeah. And it's also the people that, you know, get the job done. So it's,
yes,
it's multifaceted.
Yes.
And that's
that makes a lot of sense.
That are contributing in all of their actions.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's no good having someone on the team that just likes to run around and find conflicts and bring people together.
Right.
Cause they're probably going to start getting really good at finding conflicts and making more noise.
Right.
Yeah. The territorial firefighter. That's really cool. We talked about coaching. We talked about the triad. What else is your view on coaching? I mean, you've gone out and become certified as a coach. There's a really interesting phenomenon happening out there, in my opinion, in a lot of teams right now, which is that executive teams, and this might be very relevant in the context of your former learning role, enterprise learning role at Geico too. There's a lot of teams who are saying, well, learning and development is great, but I need to make real impact. I need to make impact quickly. I need to make it at an individual level that's tailored to the team dynamics. So I'm seeing more coaches being used, not just in the executive suite, but also throughout the organization. Anything that you're seeing that drives that?
Yeah, I think everyone can benefit from coaching.
Right.
And ideally, we would get to the point where every leader that has people reporting to them understands the value of coaching and is able to tap into other people's best. Because if you think about coaching, it really is helping people discover how they can become better. And it's not about a coach staying with them for the rest of their lives. It's about the coach helping them understand how to develop their own skills so that they can continue to evolve on an ongoing basis. And it's creating some of those habits and behaviors that might have been limiting them before that now empower them to move forward.
I like that. My coach will work a lot with me on mindset first, knowing why I want to do something differently, and then working on the skill set. And it's actually a really good approach, because whenever I run into a problem where I know I'm stuck, you can feel it. You can feel it in the pit of your stomach. I'm like, okay, have I got a mindset problem now or a skill set problem? Where do I need to adjust? And it's just, it does give you this lifelong learning, this trajectory and agility that, you know, nothing against more traditional learning and development modules, but they don't land in the same way, because this is something that is more real-time applicable in a lot of different scenarios.
Yeah, and I think a lot of learning and development gets at the skill piece of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't get at the mindset and building resilience. And if you think about, you know, there is a need to be uncomfortable all the time so that you can get better. And being able to understand, how do I work with this discomfort? Like you said, you felt it in your gut. How do I use it to help me move forward? It's funny, one of the other things that I do with a lot of people is talk about a traffic light.
Uh-huh.
And I use the traffic light for them when they are going to meet with their team to understand what is the mindset, but also for themselves. So let me just think about where I am right now. If it's red, I'm in panic, I'm in the forest state. If it's yellow, I am cautiously optimistic or cautiously pessimistic. And I'm going to listen to what you have to say and then decide whether or not I'm going to give it any credibility. Or if you're in the green stage, it's everybody's feeling great. Everything is confident. You just say it and it happens. There's nobody that lives in that state forever. I think
no.
You know, the majority of people live in yellow. So gauging your audience before you have a conversation and gauging yourself. So you really prepare yourself to, what would it take for me to get to that green state? What do I have to explore on my own in advance so I can feel comfortable? And then how do I get my team there so that we can operate at the highest level and be the highest performing team that we're capable of?
That's cool. Again, very, very intentional and structured too. But it doesn't take a lot of planning, which suits my style.
Yeah.
I like quick fixes, things that I can just tune into in the moment. And I don't have to spend half an hour preparing my agenda.
Right. Yeah. It's just that quick gut check.
Yeah, that's very cool. I want to move on to your leadership philosophy, but before we do that, we've touched on the seven behaviors. Anything else about the rules of engagement that you think we should dive into?
I think the only other piece is that you really can't hope for change. Like, you have to be intentional about making a difference and figure out what has to get executed. So that means that you understand how you, your team, and every member on your team understands what they have to execute. Create the right monitoring plan, whatever that is for your organization, so that you know that it's being executed and it's executed in the way that you need it to be. And that if you can, you know, need to make an adjustment, you can. And then support. So figure out where the plan is going awry and intervene proactively before things really become a problem.
Yeah. The intervention's big too, because you see that a lot. I've fallen into that trap before too. When things aren't going great, you're like, oh, it's going to take me time to deal with that problem, so I'm just going to deal with it later. Where the sooner you can run to the problem, the better for everyone.
Right. And sometimes it's because, you know, there was a misunderstanding. Sometimes
yes.
It's not the right plan.
Yeah.
So the sooner you can intervene, it allows people to make mistakes fast or fail fast, and then you fix it.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, if you're going to create a culture of execution, there's some steps involved. And the first step is building trust. And then the second step is, what are the expectations, and being really clear. And then delegate and figure out who you should delegate what to. And that, you know, is really a matter of, is the person working at their highest level of capacity?
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that people aren't contributing. It's that people are at different stages in their development. So you want to find ways for everyone to always be working on the work that's at their highest level. And it's most rewarding too.
It feels super rewarding. Yeah, the days don't go slow when you're doing work that's really a stretch, a challenge, and fabulous to do.
Right. And then it helps everyone around you learn more, because they're all getting that opportunity to do that. And then you hold everyone accountable to make sure that they contribute to their role. Clearly communicate consequences up front, so there's no surprises. Surprises are only good for birthdays, but they are not good at work.
Consequences is a great word. I'm glad you brought that up, because as we were talking this through, I went back to a conversation I had yesterday with my son's therapist about raising teenagers and the importance of intervening and setting appropriate consequences. So in a parenting scenario, she's like, well, if someone's not getting out of bed in the morning to go to school on time, then don't say you'll have no phone in the afternoon, because that consequence isn't attached to the dysfunction. Say, well, tonight before you go to bed, we're going to have to set your alarm and lay out all of your clothes ready for tomorrow, and make it annoying, but make it a consequence attached to them getting up and getting moving at the right time. So how have you seen consequences best framed in a team setting?
So I like to use the word creative consequences.
Okay.
And I think the consequence has to be something that's important to the person. So the same way that the therapist said it has to be timely, I think the relevance is most important. And if you think about, if I don't want this to happen, and that's the consequence that's tied to the action, I'm going to suck it up and I'm going to do what I have to do. So if you think about the easiest one that comes to mind is, if a salesperson is not delivering the quality that you need, then you slow down the sales process to ensure that the quality is there. And they're not going to like that, because they can't close as many sales, get as many bonus dollars as if they were executing at a fast level.
Oh, so I like that.
Finding what's important to them and how they're rewarded and what they're motivated by, and tying the consequence to that, makes it meaningful. But you also have to make sure they understand why you're asking them to do this. Well, if it's not important to them, there might be some education that has to come up first. And during that education, you explain the creative consequence of if this doesn't happen,
this is where we
go. To be the outcome. And then
that can be very individualistic then too. It doesn't have to be a team level consequence.
No, I think it's better. I mean, there are going to be some team consequences if it's a team goal, but if you think about individual contributions to the team,
yeah,
and someone is not meeting the expectation of that, that consequence should be related to them and it should be individual.
Got it. No, that's
helpful. And there's some times that, you know, the consequence could be as a result of them not sharing information. So then they may have to go back and circle back to all the people that didn't have the opportunity to get that information at the time and do an apology or an explanation. And if people are willing to step up and explain where they fell short and why and take responsibility for it, that strengthens the team.
And the trust.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another creative consequence, is circling back.
Yeah.
And explaining why you did what you did and taking responsibility for it.
I've always liked that circle back method. That's really neat. Well, we've already come up on 45 minutes. This has been a fun conversation. There's a lot more that I'm sure we could talk to. Maybe we have to do a version two at some stage. But if I was to highlight, Maria, some big takeaways, I love the fact that you named the crisis of trust, because I think every team is suffering through that. We talked about in your seven behaviors, the coaching element and the importance of coaching, both as a capability to help people be better in organizations, but also framing out a triad and sharing it with others, including bringing some accountability partners in. So I really enjoyed that. One of my favorite sound bites was to learn through people. So learn the business through people and learn the people at the same time. I think that's super powerful. And again, you shared that provides some coaching opportunity. And then I'm really excited to see your patented goals and priorities approach. I really like the cascade flow that you had there for the individuals and the teams across the organization. So there's a lot of really powerful elements, but it does all come back to that statement that you made, that, you know, the whole reason for being is to make the team better as a leader. So it's been a refreshing and very practically minded conversation. So thank you.
You're very welcome. I'll have to come back and I'll share my model and we can talk HR economics.
I really want to get into HR economics. That's going to be a big one. We might have to do a round table or something and create a bit of a conversation around a few different people in that too.
That would be fun.
That'll be fun. So Maria, if any of our listeners are excited to engage with you as a coach or to do some of this other work around leadership brand in their teams, how do they best find you?
So we have a website for the company. It's garangellaconsulting.com. And then you can contact me on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Or email me at maria@garangellaconsulting.com.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I've really enjoyed the conversation, Maria. Thanks again for the time. And we'll definitely make sure to follow up and do something together on this framework of goals and priorities.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,